according to your remote, I'm Jeff Custer, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We are repeating the mistakes of our apartheid rulers. We are repeating the mistakes of tyrants across the world who use issues like this to create hatred, to create division.
That's Nissan Baltoun from South Africa's Ahmed Kathrad Foundation, who says operations targeting at coercing foreign nationals to leave are a disgrace. Details coming up. Also, Somalia's presidential elections, already delayed, are delayed again. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The United Nations Security Council is extending the mission of the 19,000-strong UN peacekeeping force in South Sudan for a year. According to the Associated Press, the UN is also demanding an immediate end to fighting in the country and political dialogue to advance a plan to prevent the world's newest nation from returning to civil war. The UN resolution was adopted by a vote of 13-0, with Russia and China abstaining, both calling the measure unbalanced for focusing too much on human rights. U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield welcomed the UN measure, saying it protects civilians, supports delivery of humanitarian assistance, monitors and investigates human rights, and supports the peace process. South Sudan won its independence from Sudan in 2011. In 2018, a peace deal ended a five-year civil war that killed an estimated 400,000 people. Hundreds still die in intercommunal violence around the country. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has turned Moscow into a global pariah, likely reversing the progress Russia made in recent years to increase its influence in the Middle East. The Russian intervention in Syria has consisted of about 3,000 to 5,000 military personnel based in two main facilities, a naval facility at Taratus on the Mediterranean coast, from which Russia has operated for many decades, and the Bassel al-Assad airbase in Latakia province. David DeRoche, associate professor at the U.S. National Defense University, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi how the invasion of Ukraine could impact Russia's strategy in Syria, Libya, and Sudan.
The Russian presence in Syria is an economic loser. They have spent billions of dollars there. They're never going to get it back. And now their economy is just in a horrible position. I mean, literally a ruble note is worth less than two squares of toilet paper. So you're better off using ruble notes than toilet paper. So they cannot really sustain their presence in Syria for long if the economy considers to be this bad. I imagine that what they'll probably do is seek to downscale their presence at Haminah Air Base, which is the expensive part of the operation, but try to keep the naval base at Tartus, which has been in their presence for a long time, is just key to their presence in the region. But they'll probably hand over more and more of the fighting to the Bashar al-Assad regime and to the Iranian forces and the Iranian proxies in Syria and seek to downscale their presence there.
Would a down drone of Russia's military presence in Syria enable Iran to extend its influence over the Assad government in Damascus?
Yes, I think it will. You know, there's always been this uneasy alliance. It's more of a momentary coincidence of interest between Iran and Russia in Syria. And it has more to do with opposing what they see as American hegemony than it does with any real shared view of the world or how the world should be. So I think if Russia downscales, Iran will say, okay, this is our opportunity to exert max influence over the Bashar al-Assad regime. I don't think that Iran will increase the number of Iranians steadily, but they can increase the numbers of their proxy forces pretty economically. So that seems to be the way I think it'll go.
Elsewhere across the Middle East and North Africa, Russia has sent contract forces into Libya to assist eastern Libyan strongman Khalifa Haftar in his efforts to consolidate control over post-Qaddafi Libya. One of Russia's strategic objectives behind supporting a strongman's rule in Libya is to get a naval base in the southern flank of NATO. Is that still feasible?
Well, good question. So the Libya intervention is fundamentally different from the Syrian intervention because it pays for itself. The Russian forces in Libya, whether they're Russian government or Wagner Group, you know, that's pretty much a facade. They are paid for. And the alliance with the United Arab Emirates provides them a pretty effective means of doing that. And I think that there is the possibility of producing significant energy. You know, there's money to be had. So the presence in Libya probably will sustain. And I'm not sure if they will be able to afford the construction needed for a naval base. But it is a possibility if the sanctions continue for a long time. The Russians may say, look, you know, this base in Tartus is of limited use to us and it costs too much, but we could probably have a self-sustaining base in Libya. So they might be willing to consider a move. But that would require a much longer period of sanctions before I think that calculus would become operative.
Russia has been also backing the military coup leaders in Sudan with a desire to have a naval base in Port Sudan. Would the tension with NATO over Ukraine heighten such desire?
I'm sure the desire is there to have bases, but I'm not sure if they have the means. So it's uncertain to me that Sudan would be able, you know, the guys who have the deal for the oil in Sudan are the Chinese, not the Russians. And Russia is increasingly becoming a subordinate power to China. So I don't think that they would be able to displace the Chinese interest in Sudanese oil. So there's no money there for it. And I think that going forward, it looks like we're in for a prolonged period of very, very rough sanctions. And I think that Russia is only going to be able to consider those military interventions that pay for themselves. It looks like Sudan will not be one of those.
That was David DeRoche, Associate Professor at the U.S. National Defense University, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Three of Somalia's five states missed yesterday's deadline for electing members of parliament. The delay further postpones the selection of a new president more than a year after President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed's mandate expired. For more, Kate Pound-Dawson spoke with editor Mohamed Olad with VOA's Somali service.
Kate, voting process has missed the deadline again after countless delays and missed deadlines. The lower house elections were due to be completed on March 15th. And now Somalia's election commission said they have pushed back the deadline, delaying until March 31st, a process that's already more than a year overdue and has resulted in political sanctions by the United States and international rapprochement. So far, three of Somalia's five states had selected their representatives by deadline, according to election officials, and some 39 of 275 seats remained unfilled in Hirshabelle, Jubaland, and Puntland states.
Now, what does this mean for the process of selecting the next president?
It means that Somalia is still in political turmoil. Some leaders are not trusting each other, and that the country is in a drought. So it will only exacerbate the already volatile situation in Somalia in terms of insecurity by the Al-Shabaab militant group, which continues to attack bases in south and central Somalia. And it means further delays means also more international pressure by the United States, by the European Union, by the African Union, and those who are partners with Somalia. They have been pressuring the government, they have been pressuring the politicians that elections will be held on time. but delays still continue. And this means if Somali leaders do not come up with a plan for fulfilling this election and avoid further delays, maybe the solution would be easier. But if these delays continue, it means a political crisis. It means international pressure again.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the plan is for the next 2 weeks to try to actually get it done? Is much known about what the next steps are?
Kate, the Federal Election Implementation Team said in its latest revised timetable, these vacancies would be filled by the end of the month, and the official final results of the lower and upper house ballots announced on March 31st. Then all elected representatives would be sworn in into office in Mogadishu on April 14th. Then the two chambers of parliament intend to choose a president, and until representatives for both are elected and sworn in, the vote cannot proceed. No date was set for the election of the president and the speaker of parliament. And of course, according to the nature of this election, its further delays cannot be ruled out, because elections were marred by delays after delays. The election for lower and upper house lawmakers were supposed to be completed before President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed's term expired in February 2021, and since delays after delays.
That was my colleague, Mohamed Olad, with VOA Somali Service. He was speaking with VOA's editor, Kate Bond-Dawson. Olad also said the United States, which is the largest donor nation for Somalia, has said it is disappointed by the delay. The U.S. Embassy has warned further delays could lead to more sanctions on political leaders. The Anti-Racism Network in South Africa has begun its annual campaign aimed at eradicating racism and xenophobia in the country. The organization says its focus this year is mainly on growing racism in schools and increasing anti-immigrant sentiment. Tusokumalo reports from Johannesburg.
In a symbolic gesture, the Anti-Racism Network launched its campaign at the Sharpeville Memorial Exhibition Center. It was there in 1960 that apartheid police gunned down 69 people for protesting laws that forced black South Africans to carry passes that gave them access to whites-only areas. The Anti-Racism Network says now it is racism in schools that concerns its members most. Last week, the Department of Education had to suspend the principal of Grosvenor Girls High School in Durban, KwaZulu-Natal, after black students went on strike, accusing white teachers of calling them monkeys. Several incidents of racism have plagued a few schools this year. Currently, the Human Rights Commission of South Africa is investigating racism in the advertising sector. This follows outcries over several advertisements with racial undertones. These include a clothing retailer that used a black child with a caption, "The coolest monkey in the jungle." The Anti-Racism Network campaign also takes aim at xenophobia. A growing number of groups and political parties have been demanding that foreigners leave. Nishan Balton from the Ahmed Kathrada Foundation told those present at the launch of the Racism Week that operations targeted at foreign nationals were a disgrace.
We launch what is called Operation Dudula and other initiatives to chase them away in the most undignified and inhumane manner. We are repeating the mistakes of our apartheid rulers. We are repeating the mistakes of tyrants across the world who use issues like this to create hatred, to create division.
Since 2008, South Africa has seen waves of anti-foreigner sentiment, which often has led to protests that at times turn into deadly riots. In the past few months, anti-foreigner sentiment has risen sharply as the country grapples with an unemployment rate of nearly 40%. Many South Africans say the more than 3 million immigrants in the country are taking jobs from citizens. Despite the Anti-Racism Network's campaign, Some groups do not agree that racism is growing in South Africa. Gabriel Cruz, head of campaigns at the Institute of Race Relations, told the panel conducting recent hearings that there is a tendency to exaggerate racism.
There is good news in this country that most ordinary South Africans, at least when it comes to race, are in a much better place than we have ever been in before. Unemployment is the greatest problem in this country. Race relations, meanwhile, have never been better.
The government has drafted a national action plan to combat racism, xenophobia, discrimination, and others. There also is pending legislation to prevent and combat hate crimes and hate speech. Once passed, the bill would criminalize acts of racism and xenophobia. The annual Anti-Racism Week culminates on March 21st, which is South Africa's Human Rights Day and the anniversary of the Sharpeville massacre. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
A new report by Human Rights Watch finds the Malian army and armed Islamist groups allegedly killed at least 107 civilians in central and southwestern Mali since December 2021, and most of the victims, including village chiefs, religious leaders, and children, were summarily executed. Human Rights Watch's Sahel director, Corneen Dufka, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the actions against civilians appear to include war crimes.
We documented a very, very worrying spike in alleged killings, including, in fact, most of them being summary executions. They involved both the armed Islamist groups as well as the army who allegedly killed these people in the context of counterterrorism operations.
You say in the report that the victims include traders, village chiefs, religious leaders, even children?
Yes, we documented 8 incidents of alleged summary executions and killings. 2 of them involved the armed Islamist groups, including a worrying incident when they opened fire on a bus, killing 32 civilians on their way to market. And then 6 incidents involving the army during counterterrorism operations. And now, a few of these appear to be reprisal attacks. That is, that they went after communities after soldiers were killed near these communities, apparently blaming them for the IED explosion, which killed their soldiers. In another case, and this is the worst allegation involving the army that we have documented in the last decade, they took out 35 men, suspects who'd been detained in the Diabali army camp and then executed them about 11 miles away.
If you could just back up a little bit and tell us what's going on in Mali. Why is there this spike in deadly violence there?
Well, Mali has encountered an overlapping crisis, both security, humanitarian, and political, since 2012, when northern Mali fell to separatist rebels, Tuareg separatist rebels, and armed Islamists. Since that time, the armed Islamists have expanded their reach into central Mali, then Burkina Faso, and are now threatening other littoral West African countries. In response, then, the Malian army has engaged in counterterrorism operations, and many of these incidents have occurred within the context of these, at times, abusive counterterrorism operations.
When you talk about abuse, it sounds like it even goes further than abuse. Could these constitute as war crimes?
They absolutely could be considered war crimes. Now, Human Rights Watch is not a judicial entity, which is why we are calling on the Malians to conduct proper in-depth investigations and find those alleged to be involved, and also for them to allow for independent investigations by the National Human Rights Commission and then by the Human Rights Section of the UN Peacekeeping Force in Mali.
How stable is the government right now? I mean, could they actually carry out such independent investigations, and the results of which could be viewed as legitimate?
The government is indeed a transitional government as a result of 2 coups which occurred within a short period of time in Mali. But the judiciary is still functioning. They have a military justice directorate, which is still functioning. Now, in the past, we have been disappointed by the lack of response by the judicial authorities to other allegations involving the security forces. So, you know, we're asking them to ensure rights-respecting counterterrorism operations. They are important for both principled reasons, of course, because killing suspects and civilians are against national and international laws, but also for practical reasons, because these kinds of allegations simply push more and more people into the hands of violent non-state actor groups.
That was Corinne Dufka Sahel, a director at Human Rights Watch. She was speaking to Carol Van Dam in Washington on Tuesday. In Zimbabwe, the top official for tourism now says proof of COVID-19 vaccination may not be required to enter the country. While the hospitality sector is eager to see more visitors, so far there are no details about the plan. Arigando in Bulawayo gives us more.
Tourism and Hospitality Minister Mangaliso Ndlovu, in an interview with the state-controlled Sunday Mail, said that vaccination certificates for visitors were an advantage, but that visitors must show a negative PCR test valid for more than 48 hours after arrival to enter Zimbabwe. Ndlovu spent several days last week touring border areas. A Zimbabwe Tourism Authority spokesman confirmed the pronouncement reflects a government decision. However, Chief Koti said so far no statutory instrument or SI has been issued to implement the new measures.
We need to align to that as such. There's no SI that is out as yet, but they were doing border tours, him and the Ministry of Home Affairs, I think Defense as well, throughout the last week. So I'm sure it's a position that is agreed upon as government. So it means that when you come to the border, then you should be able to come through without that vaccination, as long as you produce that negative PCR test, which is within the time frame that is required.
The government reopened the country's land borders last month after having closed the ports of entry for nearly a year to curb the spread of the pandemic. Many businesses in the tourism and hospitality sector have struggled to survive during the pandemic, which sharply curtailed world travel. According to the World Bank, Zimbabwe's tourist arrivals sank to about 640,000 in 2020, down from 2.3 million in 2019, a loss of more than $620 million. Ross Kennedy of Africa Obida, which operates lodges in the famous Victoria Falls area, welcomes the new COVID-19 measures, saying his sector has suffered massive losses.
From every possible angle, employment, community, revenue, viability, damage to destination reputation, etc., airlines pulling out, it has been devastating.
Luke Brown of the Zambezi Conservation Alliance joins Kennedy in welcoming the land border reopenings.
Many have now started to begin a recovery process. In terms of readiness for COVID-19, I think early on was prepared. We were fortunate in that the government supported us with early vaccinations. In so far as hotel staff and staff supporting the tourism industry were vaccinated, which boosted confidence, importantly, amongst the tourist mindset who are visiting Zimbabwe. I think the recent opening of borders in Zimbabwe will really now help us to make a full recovery. We'll certainly boost the industry.
Michael Ndiweni of the Blawayo Vendors and Traders Associations sees the new measures as positive, as many of his group members sell craftsware to tourists.
It's going to assist those that are stuck, particularly in the course, traders in the course, actually survive on selling their crafts to and the assets to tourists. So the opening of borders will really be helpful to their business.
Still, COVID-19 is very much alive globally, and Zimbabwe health professionals warn citizens to maintain vigilance. Kennedy says the hospitality sector will work to protect clients by following recommended health practices. He says in Victoria Falls, businesses are coordinating closely to keep customers and staff safe. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Last night in Dakar, Senegal, Morocco's AS Saleh earned a slot in the Basketball Africa League playoffs with a 91-86 win over the home team Dakar University Club. Also on Tuesday, REG of Rwanda finished on top of the standings after defeating Mozambique's club Ferroviario da Beira 94-89 in Dakar. As Saleh and REG will join Tunisia's U.S. Monastir and Guinean basketball team Selak in the playoffs, which tip off May 21st in Kigali, Rwanda. Attention now shifts to the Nile Conference's group phase. The conference will play at the Hassan Mustafa Complex in Cairo, Egypt, starting April 9th. You can catch all the action next month right here on the Sunny Side of Sports. Follow Sunny on Twitter and Facebook for highlights and team details. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and